that's the state of the art. I mean, that's it. I mean, because if this was China and we could mobilize 1 billion people and give each of them, you know, at one of those big things of sorbent, we still wouldn't get 365 miles done by fall.
That damage can be either death or malformation of the organism. So the presence of large amounts of oil in the water or on the kelp could have very serious effects on the eggs and juveniles.
You say you never looked at the contingency plan. You didn't study it. I say that says that Exxon apparently didn't give a damn for the people of Alaska or for the otters. Why didn't you take the responsibility of making certain that if an accident happened, there would be a contingency plan you could live with?
We do have excess capacity here in Valdez. That has not prevented us from building a facility in Seward.
I guess,
we are expanding.
I mean, the point, I guess, is that the Exxon experts will always rule. The Exxon experts will rule on otters, they'll rule on dispersants, they'll rule on skimming, they'll rule on contingency plans.
It's a complicated scheme of legislation, among other things, raising the tax on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, ordering the Coast Guard to watch traffic more closely, and establishing an oil spill research center in Cordova. Stephen says with Senator Johnston's backing, he hopes all the bills can reach the Senate floor this summer. Under one of the bill's provisions, the Coast Guard would immediately take over the response to any spill over 1 million barrels. The senator says when he investigated the Exxon spill, he decided that's what was needed.
I still firmly believe that the federal government should have taken control of the efforts immediately and triggered the responses that would be necessary to try and curtail the spread of this oil.
Stephen says he has to believe that the technology and ability do exist to clean up and contain a spill of this size, and that it's only a question of being prepared. So the bill contains numerous provisions designed to be sure that happens. Extended radar range in the sound, a requirement to have 3 officers on the bridge when the tanker's moving through the sound, oil booms on board and deployed where they can be used, and availability of arrest records to the Coast Guard. Stephen says the measure is designed to assure that the human negligence that led to the spill will be less likely. Asked what negligence he meant, he said it could be not just the tanker crew, but also Alyeska and Exxon. The senator says the name of the game now is show me, and until the oil industry can show the state of Alaska what it has tried to say it had all along, there should be no further oil exploration in Alaska or its waters, in Bristol Bay or anywhere else.
I do not think we ought to have exploration offshore or onshore in new areas until the credibility of the system is restored and Alaskans once again believe in it.
The senator's bill may not have quite all the requirements in it that the governor would like to see. It calls for a study of double-bottom tankers instead of ordering them and does not require pilots aboard tankers for their entire trip through Prince William Sound. But Stevens did consult with State Environmental Conservation Commissioner Denny Kelso in drafting the measure. And the intent appears to be similar to the Cooper administration's. The Coast Guard should have the power and resources to clean up any future spill, and the industry should have to prove it can be done, even if it means using smaller tankers. And Stephen says when he's talking about cleaning up, he's not talking about massive spraying of dispersants, but about actually picking up the oil.
We've got to proceed on the basis that the industry has the duty to show us that oil spills are containable. That was what we relied on at the time we authorized the pipeline.
Under the bill, the Coast Guard would have $150 million available for spill response. Stephen says this in no way would diminish the liability of the parties at fault. The bill has another provision that would amend the federal disaster law to include oil spills, now ruled out because they're not so-called acts of God. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
As his ship is emptied and cleaned in Seward, the captain of the Vida Gubsky has had time to reflect on the job it did. Captain Sergei Rakin talked through an interpreter yesterday with Joan Skogan, a freelance reporter in Seward. The captain says he is satisfied with the way his ship was able to function, collecting more than 82,000 gallons of oil, not through the skimmer, but through a modification of the dredge. His only regret, the Vida Gubsky did not arrive sooner. If such a catastrophe should happen again, Captain Vreken hopes the response will be different. Mikhail Yakimenko translates.
I know that it's very important to understand for us, Soviets and for Americans, that we must have any kind of special center, joint center, for coordination, for cooperation in such a work with a so huge spill. To do it in a short period, immediately.
Captain Vreken hopes the coordination of effort and cooperation in future oil spill responses will be like the excellent international teamwork he saw aboard his ship. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Sue Burris.
We believe that if properly handled, spills are containable and the oil can be picked up before substantial damage is done. Should we allow 2 million barrel tankers to come in there if they can't contain the spill from one that size? Now, that's up to the industry, I think, to restore credibility on that. I think we should accept any plan that was prepared prior to the spill as being demonstrably effective until it's proven to be so.
The senator says Alaska is stuck with the risk of the Trans-Alaska pipeline, but before the state is put any more at risk by looking for oil in new places, the industry ought to show it can do what it said it could do when the pipeline was approved. And he doesn't mean spraying massive amounts of dispersant to sink oil spills. He means cleaning them up before they make landfall.
We believe that if properly handled, spills are containable and the oil can be picked up before substantial damage is done.
The Stevens bill would require a study of changing tanker designs, even downsizing them. It would set up an oil spill study center in Cordova and put the Coast Guard automatically in charge of any spill over 1 million barrels. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel. The senator introduced a set of bills tightening up tanker regulation Tuesday. He says the Prince William Sound tanker fleet may have to be downsized if the oil industry can't show it's capable of cleaning up the oil a big tanker could spill before it does damage.
Should we allow 2 million barrel tankers to come in there if they can't contain the spill from one that size? Now, that's up to the industry, I think, to restore credibility on that.
Stevens' bill would force the Coast Guard to take over any spill over 1 million barrels, something he says should have been done in Prince William Sound. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The oil could have been scooped up. We could have stopped it at Gore Point with any kind of cooperation from them. They're not cooperating. I consider that a threat to our lives.
The DEC has already been inspecting seafood, but now an intensified multi-level program is being developed. The program calls for mandatory inspections of any vessel previously involved in oil cleanup operations. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game will also be working with the DEC to survey fishing grounds. Fishermen and tender operators will then be required to check the catch and gear of vessels. Processors in oil-affected areas will also be visited several times a day by the DEC to check for contamination, and samples will be sent to a lab in Palmer to confirm the assessments of the on-site inspectors. According to Doug Donegan of the DEC, the inspection program will start with the upcoming halibut opening and will continue until at least August.
We'll keep an eye on things, you know, for some time in the future. It may well be that we'll find we have to do this next year as well.
In Kodiak, I'm Matt Miller.
Exxon has been asked by the Homer Multi-Agency, or MAC, team to have large barges on site that can unload vessels that have been picking up oil on the water and the beach. No barges have arrived, and at this point, none are on the way. Exxon spokesman Dan Jones says his company is aware of the problem. Jones says Exxon is trying its best to locate large barges that can take on the oil that is being recovered. Those efforts were questioned by Coast Guard Commander Rich Asaro, who said if the vessels aren't available locally, then surely there are some in the lower 48. Asaro said they should have been contacted earlier and told by Exxon to come to Alaska. When asked by Department of Environmental Conservation Representative Don Segrin what's been done by Exxon to locate barges, Dan Jones said he didn't know. Segrin said there's really no excuse for Exxon not to have barges on site taking on oil.
It's just poor planning on their part. I mean, we're how many weeks into this spill? 6, 8 weeks, whatever we are now. They could have been looking for barges and looking ahead from the day it spilled rather than waiting for it for now.
In what's become almost a routine procedure following each MAC team request, there are charges that Exxon is stalling and not willing to put forth the effort required to get the job done. Marge Tillian is working with the Kenai Peninsula Borough's Incident Command Team. She says lists of barges and vessels that are ready to go to work have been on Exxon's desk for weeks. She said, for the most part, Exxon isn't making use of the resources available. The latest confrontation with Exxon has led one of the MAC team members to take drastic action. John Michelson of Seldovia handed Exxon representative Dan Jones a declaration of arrest. Michelson is upset with what he considers Exxon's criminal activity in Homer since the company arrived 5 weeks ago.
I recognize lying going on here every day. I've researched, you know, I've been here for 44 days or however long. I've personally called all over the world finding materials, booming material, absorbent material, tankage material, help vessels. They tell us it's not available. That's a blatant lie. The stuff is available. That's just a blatant disregard for human life. It kills the food on the beach when the oil goes. The oil could have been scooped up. We could have stopped it at Gore Point with any kind of cooperation from them. They're not cooperating. I consider that a threat to our lives.
Michelson's attempt at a citizen's arrest of the Exxon representative may not amount to much more than a statement. Dan Jones read the declaration of arrest and had no comment other than to just walk away. Michelson said he is pursuing legal avenues to see what options are open to make his charges stick. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
Federal on-scene coordinator Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins says several directives must be accomplished before he will support Exxon's shoreline restoration plan. Robbins wants more people and resources to clean more than 300 miles of oily shoreline and says critical equipment and supplies must be increased. Robbins offered federal assistance in locating materials. Robbins added that renewed cleanup efforts may be required next spring, and he also wants access to daily work intention so he can monitor the progress of beach cleanup throughout the summer. The deadline for cleanup is still September 15th. Robbins spent today visiting several rookery areas in Prince William Sound that were supposed to have been cleaned by today. However, the deadline was extended for 5 days since pupping won't occur until around May 20th. The rookeries on Smith Island, Green Island, and Applegate Rock are high priorities because of the concern for the young sea lions. There's good news from the Department of Environmental Conservation. Water quality studies show that there were no dangerous amounts of hydrocarbons found in the water column after the Exxon Valdez dumped almost 11 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound. Fishermen are concerned the chemicals would pollute the water column and contaminate the fish. The water was tested to a depth of 6 meters in various locations around the sound. Testing is continuing. The halibut and salmon fisheries are set to begin Monday. A new seafood inspection program is in place to monitor the quality of the fish after the spill. Inspectors under the direction of the DEC are based in Cordova, Valdez, Whittier, Seward, Homer, and Kodiak. The DEC has drafted emergency regulations to expand the inspection program. The regulations, expected to be approved by Friday, will give the DEC authority to conduct new or additional inspections of fishing vessels, tenders, and processors. For APRN, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez.
Globs of oil moose have been reported on Seven Mile Beach, a stretch of coastline midway between Larson Bay and Karlick. And fishing vessels are now at work corralling strands of moose out of Uyak Bay, an area used heavily by both villages. Karlick Mayor Ronnie Lind is upset, not only about the oil, but about the way the villages have been left out of the oil cleanup system of operations.
I think my way of life, a subsistence way of life, is really threatened. And I don't see you out there trying to, or anybody up in that panel up there asking us how we feel.
Lind asked Exxon for an assurance that they would not forget the needs of the villages. Actually, there's been no shortage of assurances, but action is another story. Exxon developed what they termed a rapid response plan for the villages, The plan called for establishing communication with each of the villages. It also called for sending an Exxon team into each community for a couple of hours of boom deployment training. The six villages were supposed to be trained by April 28th, but as of today, three of the villages, including Karlik, have not been contacted by Exxon, much less received any training. According to Dolly Reft of the Kodiak Area Native Association, village residents are also frustrated that VECO hires fishing vessels from town to go over and clean up oiled areas near the villages while the village boats sit idle.
And I think the villages are at a point in right now where they're tired of asking, and they're at the point where they're making demands. They feel that they are the experts in their environment that can clean their rocks or beaches or pick up the tar balls. They want to do that. And they feel that because they have a love for their land and that land is their survival, that they should be the ones that are included in this local hire and whole process of cleaning up. They don't want to see any more people coming out there running into rocks because they don't know the environment.
Ref said the villages are sick of waiting around for help and information. She says if they have to, they'll take their boats out and put people on the beach to clean, with or without the help of Exxon or VECO. Exxon representative John Harrington, who just arrived in Kodiak today, said part of the problem was that Exxon people were diverted to work on operations for the Katmai Coast, and it's been difficult to define what the needs are for each particular area.
And that wasn't something we could define, unfortunately, until the oil came through. I hope we can all have the maturity now, and I can't ask for any more patience. I know you're just about out of patience, justifiably, to go forward. We now have the problem defined. The front has come and gone. We can't even find an oil front out in the open sea. So what that tells us is we have the problem defined. Whatever resources it takes, we're going to continue to grow until we handle the problem.
But Kodiak Mayor Bob Brody said that's just not good enough. People don't believe promises anymore. Fisherman Dave Harville said if it's been difficult to define the needs for each area, it may be because every couple of weeks, Exxon sends in someone new to take over operations in Kodiak.
I understand the psychology behind bringing in a manager and then taking him out again. It's a psychology banks use, and it keeps familiarity from occurring, which I happen to be, I don't like that. I think these people should come down. I think they should meet the people and greet the people and learn who they're working with. And I think it's remiss to, when a person just gets to the point where he begins to understand the problem, he gets yanked out. Well, I'm tired, I've got to go.
Exxon representative John Harrington said he won't be taking off after a couple of weeks. As for the villages, Harrington said he'll personally visit each of them this week and get to work immediately on providing them with materials, training, and boat contracts. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Hey, Mr. Belli, first, how did you arrive at such a figure, $900 billion?
Well, we didn't, because I specifically did not put a figure in the complaint. I don't like to do that. But someone asked me what I thought the case was worth, and I said, I can't tell you because we haven't calculated yet, but we've heard from environmentalists and a lot of people in Alaska that could go up to $900 billion. So that came from some of the people up there, not from us, because I wouldn't know at the present time what it was.
You really don't have a figure in your mind, is that correct?
I don't have a figure in mind. When I first heard about it and first got into it, Ed Rezor, who used to be your former attorney general, called me and said that if I would come up and try them, that he would take them on. And I said, I'd love to, because I love Alaska, and I think this was the rape of Alaska, and we might be able to do something in this case with people not to treat the environment so lightly. And I said I would come up. That's how I happened to get into it. I come up there all frequently just to look at the northern lights. I remember the last case I tried up there, the first case I tried was when Alaska was still a territory. I tried one against the Alaska Railroad.
Did you win that one?
Yeah, we won that. We got the highest award that ever gotten in Alaska up to that time, and it was $75,000. And then Bailey Bell, who was with me, went to the judge, and he says, the jury bought our formula, but they calculated wrong. Should be $150,000. And oh, I almost fainted. I said, Lord, you got the highest award they ever had up here, and then you want to raise it? The judge says, yes, it should be. And so he gave us $150,000. I was tickled to death.
Yeah. On this oil industry suit, now, are you representing specific fishermen, or is this a class action or what?
Now we're representing specific fishermen. We're representing people down in the state of Washington. We're representing groups all over Alaska. I'd say all of them together, we probably have 1,000 people. Boat owners, boat builders, some of them had their contracts for boats canceled. So we've got all sorts and classes of people.
How big a suit is this as far as your own practice is concerned? Have you filed similar suits as far as the extent of the damage?
We had the one in Bhopal, the explosion over there. Then we also had the KAL suit that was the plane that was shot down by the Russians. We've had any number of class actions like this. But I'd say when this is all over with, after a couple of years and we got determination of the damages, probably be one of the biggest ones that has been handled by anyone.
What do you see as the major trial issue here? Is it blame or is it the extent of damage?
I think the major trial issue is going to be extent of damage because blame is pretty clear. Exxon is going to be responsible over and above the pipeline. The pipeline is responsible up to over $100 million. But over and above that, you're going to go after Exxon and other people that are involved. And I think by the time that we get it to trial and get started, there won't be any question about the culpability, who's negligent, who was wrong, unless maybe there's a problem as to whether there should be punitive damages. And I think there should be. Punitive damages are assessed by a court or a jury to tell people not to do the thing like this again, and Lord, that's what they need more than anything else. But I think the main problem will be, as we go along, the extent of the direct and indirect damage, because there could be so many people that were indirectly affected, and how far can we go on that? And there'll be people down in the lower 48 who will be making claims for damage.
The $900 billion figure that was quoted to you, that's an actual damage. That isn't punitive, is it?
No, that's not punitive. That wouldn't be punitive. But we didn't put that, again, we didn't put that in there. That was what was given to me by some of the environmentalists and some of the experts up there, just like how long will it take to make a determination what the damages are going to be. And I think I reported what was told to me. It would be up from 7 to 9 years before you get the full extent of the damages. But I think the damages, an outside, $900 billion, within the realm of practicality and reason. I don't think that's exaggerating it.
I told on the House floor to pass it, and I think it came down to a little bit of politics on the House side. I've been told a couple times by the chairman of the committee in finance, who has got a hold of the bill. He didn't really have any major problems with the bill. He wanted to look at it. He was concerned about the process. He thought he was being bypassed. So it became kind of a power struggle between in the leadership of the House. Unfortunately, that was the bill that was in the middle of it.
The fight against this bill was to see that nothing changed and nothing happened, and that's not going to be the case. So I think that it is a victory for educators in Alaska that we, you know, politically forced the issue to be dealt with through our members' concern and through really not just this year's work, but 15 years worth of work on the part of teachers.
Although the oil industry managed to soften some of the bills crafted in the immediate wake of this bill, several measures turned what used to be a slap on the wrist into serious deterrence. Over 24 bills were introduced, and many were lost in the shuffle, or their sponsors were accused of overreacting. Anchorage Democrat Red Boucher.
I call these conscience bills. All of a sudden, bills that hadn't been introduced for years here, they looked like tankers lined up outside of Valdez. I mean, it was one after the other, and it was pretty hard to evaluate what they did. This was purely reactionary legislation.
The first measure to clear both houses will make it easier for the state to collect damages. It puts strict liability on parties involved in producing, moving, storing, or using hazardous substances, including crude oil. The bill was a priority of the governor and House Democrats, and it cleared the Senate after Judiciary Chair Jan Fakes put a half dozen exemptions into the bill, like consumer products in use, automobile exhaust, and for homeowners who contract to have their sewage trucked away. Several bills were passed that deal with costs of the cleanup. The measure ups the oil production tax by 5 cents a barrel to put toward a spill fund. The increase will raise $32 million the first year. Another bill prohibits oil companies from deducting the cleanup from transportation costs, which are used to calculate wellhead value. Efforts to improve the state's ability to avoid and respond to similar disasters in the future include a bill requiring the Department of Environmental Conservation to prepare a statewide master plan, the creation of a hazardous substance response office, and the appointment of a 7-member commission to investigate the Valdez spill and make policy recommendations so the same thing doesn't happen again. The most disputed oil spill measure this session deals with civil fines for the responsible parties. Under existing law, the state can only force Exxon to pay roughly $14 million in damages for the Valdez spill, and 5 times that amount if gross negligence can be proven. Representative Kay Brown and Senator Drew Pierce worked out a compromise bill that would change the penalty structure, raising base fines and requiring them to be quintupled if the company fails to respond as promised by an approved plan. But the bill was held up by the House minority, who saw it as unnecessarily steep. The final bill decreased the multiplying factor to 4 and put a cap of $500 million on total fines. Representative Brown fought those changes and says she isn't sure it will be incentive enough for the oil industry to consider sinking several million dollars into prevention measures like double-bottom fuel tanks.
I think the technology that exists today is marginal in terms of being able to effectively deal with a spill of this size. So I think a lot more technology development is needed, and I think maybe this will encourage them to do it. But I guess I feel that if you were to have a catastrophic accident where you lost a whole tanker, that $500 million would not be sufficient to compensate the state and the people of the state for the resources and for the loss of the resources.
Brown says she will continue to try and make the fines for gross negligence tougher and to apply the penalties to spills of refined products as well. Although some lawmakers saw no need to rush the oil spill bills through this year, others say the momentum to put stricter measures on the industry will have died down by next session. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Arnold.
We urge you to continue the practice of sending sludge outside the state. There have been enough problems over the disposal of sludge at Alyeska that we do not want to revisit this issue and believe that it would be in Exxon's best interests not to become involved in Alyeska's sludge problem.
I think the technology that exists today is marginal in terms of being able to effectively deal with a spill of this size. So I think a lot more technology development is needed, and I think maybe this will encourage them to do it. If you were to have a catastrophic accident where you lost a whole tanker, that $500 million would not be sufficient to compensate the state and the people of the state for the resources and for the loss of the resources.
Exxon official Rob Dragnich said Exxon would rely heavily on existing treatment and disposal facilities at Alyeska Terminal.
The basic strategy of our plan is to implement what we call small-scale incineration, large-scale incineration, and landfilling as rapidly as possible and in parallel. We believe that this multi-approach to it will provide flexibility to accommodate any permitting delays or equipment problems that we encounter, and again ensure that the waste disposal will occur at the rate that it needs to.
But representatives of the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance, Trustees for Alaska, and Alaska Center for the Environment questioned the use of the small incinerators at a Valdez site and the use of the controversial Alyeska ballast water treatment facility. State and federal authorities must approve Exxon's plan before operations begin. And while a backlog of waste is piling up on barges and at the terminal, an Environmental Protection Agency official told the crowd that no deals have been made with Exxon and no wholesale waivers would be given to the company for waste removal. A landfill in Arlington, Oregon has been selected by Exxon for disposal of some waste. For APRN, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez.
Environmental Conservation Commissioner Denny Kelso has been making the rounds in Washington, appearing on news programs and talking to members of Congress about the Exxon Valdez spill. He thought he was going to be testifying at a House Merchant Marine Subcommittee hearing Thursday morning on an oil spill liability bill written by Committee Chairman Walter Jones. The bill would limit what an oil company is responsible for to $60 million and preempt a state law just passed that makes spill perpetrators responsible for a $500 million damage. Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost was on the slate to testify, as well as Transportation Secretary Sam Skinner, and even someone from the Pipeline Liability Fund. But Kelso was told there was no room for him on the agenda. So he talked about Alaska's concerns to reporters in the hall outside the hearing room. Kelso was later invited to submit written testimony, but was still angered about the incident when reached later in the day.
Alaskans have just experienced the largest oil spill in U.S. history. The impacts are massive. It continues even now. And for us to get our views across, we need to make sure that the committees in Congress really listen to us. It's also important for Congress to hear what it is that Alaska has experienced so that any legislation they enact can be the right kind of legislation. And it's just ridiculous not to have the opportunity to testify when we were there. The committee was considering something directly relevant to the damages that have occurred in Prince William Sound and other areas affected by the spill. And they should have had us on the agenda. We were there. We were taken off. We don't know what the reasons were. And that just seems to me to be not a very good way of going about making public policy.
Kelso says just about everybody in Congress has an oil spill bill ready to go, and Alaska's trying to watch them all closely. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve.
For 11 years, Mayor Alphonse Arzel has tried to keep the memory of the Amoco Cadiz spill alive. The tanker spilled more than 65 million gallons of oil off the coast of Brittany, far more than the 11 million gallons that the tanker Exxon Valdez dumped into Prince William Sound in March. Arzel arrived in Valdez this week to see the oil spill damage. Through an interpreter, Arzel says it's been tough to view the oiled Alaskan beaches.
He says, first of all, it's been very sad to see what was happening here because it reminds him what has happened in Brittany. And the other surprise is to see that it's totally different from what we've been doing in France, because here it is Exxon that is going to pay. And, well, he thinks that Exxon is going to pay because of the job he has been doing with Amoco, because he says he never talk or even see anybody from the Amoco or Shell. But I think the difference is that in France, it is the state that pays, and here it is Exxon. I think he didn't understand that here, if you do the oil spill, you have to pay for it. That's the main difference between you and France.
Arzel says the French are still fighting to recover costs from Amoco in the courts. 1,000 ships a week pass by the town of Portsall. Arzel says after the Amoco Cadiz disaster, laws regulating oil transportation cut down on spills. Still, there were 7 spills over 14 years, and Portsall spent a lot of francs to reassure tourists that an oil-free vacation was possible. Today, Arzel says the French beaches are clear of oil.
In France, we can say that by now it's finished, but it was 11 years ago. And we saw the oil spill yesterday, and here he thinks it's going to be very difficult because you have so many pebbles, and the oil is very inside the pebbles.
Arzel had hoped to meet with Valdez Mayor John Devens, but he was out of town. Arzel says he will propose that Portsall and Valdez become sister cities and share information on spills. As a result of the Amoco Cadiz disaster, Arzel says Brittany is prepared to handle future spills.
Yes, we are organized because we had so many, but we also have many, many pumps ready to work. But he says every time it's different, and sometimes you have to use very ordinary methods.
Exxon is using French hot water pumps in Prince William Sound, and Arzel says perhaps better communication between oil companies and affected communities around the world would help nations deal with oil spills. For APRN, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez.
By the end of today, Jim Stiers, the director of the Otter Rescue Center in Seward, expects to have more than 60 animals in his care. He says it's not the washing and drying facility that's too crowded. What they need is more rehabilitation room.
We keep adding, and hopefully by the end of next week we'll be, you know, able to keep up with it. But you know, you have to have, if animals are coming in the door, you got to send them back out the door at some point. And at this point in the game, we just don't have any place to send them.
Most of the oiled otters are now coming from Gore Point and the Chiswell Islands, and a few are still being cared for at the bird rescue facility while construction continues at the Otter Center. That construction, Stiers says, is all designed to be collapsible.
It all breaks down. Everything from the electricity to the walkways between the trailers is in modular form, and it can be broken down. The electricity can be hooked up to generators if we need. The hot water supplied by online heaters that are hooked up to butane, so that can easily be, you know, set up anywhere. The whole design is built around, you know, breaking this down, storing it, and taking it somewhere else in the world.
Stiers says the Otter Center needs two items right now. One is space for clean and dried otters to recover enough to be released. The other is volunteer help that can stay for 2 weeks or more in Seward and work long hours.
Unfortunately, we're not able to offer them much other than the experience of working with the animals. We have limited housing, and we do offer a meal during the course of the day and that sort of thing, but everything else is basically on their own, and that's the bad part. The good part is you really get a good feeling about this thing when it's all said and done, because you made a difference, you know.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Sue Burris.
Our Black Hawk case-up crew was to come in last week. We had those people lined up to case up Black Hawk, and our whole night shift didn't show up because they'd been hired by Exxon to go clean up beaches.
John Sevier is plant manager for Alaska Pacific Seafoods, one of the largest employers in Kodiak. Normally, about 275 people work at APS on a year-round basis. Altogether, the processing plants employ about 3,000 townspeople. But it won't be easy getting workers this year. Some have already gone to Vico or Exxon. Others have their applications in to work on the oil spill and are waiting to be called for one of those $16 an hour jobs. Employees aren't the only problem. Some of the town's processors have lost up to 50% of their fishing vessels to Exxon. Sevier says there's not much they can do about that, but plant managers asked Exxon representative John Harrington today to come up with an answer to the worker shortage.
Well, Exxon has come out and said that they will definitely not let the fishery fall for any reason that they may have impacted the fishery itself, for any reason at all. Exxon has come through and said that they're going to do whatever it takes for us to have a fishery with as little complications as possible in the Kodiak Island borough and around Kodiak Island, including the city of Kodiak, where we as processors have to function.
Sevier says Exxon will likely have to ship in workers from the lower 48. Exxon representative Harrington said he would come up with a plan by next Thursday. Meanwhile, processors will get through this halibut opening as best they can and hope Exxon follows through on its commitment to help.
Kodiak was the number one fish port in the United States in 1988, and in 1989, hopefully it's going to be the same.
In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
With a limited supply of containment materials on hand, cleanup crews in Larsen Bay are finding the oil hard to contain. Exxon is now working on shipping in help and materials. Meanwhile, village residents are out in skiffs scooping up oil moose out of Uyak Bay using shovels and buckets. About 1,400 gallons have been retrieved so far. Meanwhile, fresh patches of oil and moose have been found in the area of a Fognak Strait just north of Kodiak between Raspberry and Whale Islands. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has closed that area to herring fishing. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The bill was written by House Merchant Marine Committee Chairman Walter Jones. Kelso showed up at a subcommittee hearing to testify Thursday morning and was told he'd been scratched from the agenda. He went ahead and gave his testimony to reporters in the hall. He said if the bill had been in effect in March, Exxon's liability in Alaska would have already ended. He said it would preempt a state law just passed that sets a cap of $500 million, and the Jones bill would also allow oil companies to steer completely free of liability for tanker spills by using contractors.
And, of course, in this situation, the impact is just massive. So we don't think that the owner of that oil should be able just to walk away from it by saying that the owner of the tanker or the charterer of that tanker is the one who really ought to pay it.
Kelso says just about everybody in Congress has an oil spill bill now. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
What it does is accelerate the natural restoration of the beach and decomposition of the oil that's on the beach. It basically gets nature to go a little bit faster than it would if left alone.
The reports confirmed what everyone here has feared since the Exxon Valdez ran aground. Brown, sticky globs of oil were covering the beach. On the Homer Spit, the oil was stuck in between rocks, and it clung to seaweed and driftwood. There were no cleanup crews at work on the spit, but at another popular beach about a mile north, a small crew of workers, hired by Exxon, was trying to remove the oily debris from the beach. Mike Hillstrand of Homer said it was going to be a tough job.
This is pretty much all over the whole beach. And I grew up on these beaches. I used to live on the spit, and it's like my front yard here just got dumped on by Exxon, so I'm sort of upset about it, the whole thing. And I'd like to see something done about it.
The public reaction to Exxon's performance so far in Homer has been one of anger and frustration. The feeling is sure to intensify now that the oil has showed up on the beach. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
When he showed up to testify and found out there wasn't room for him on the agenda, and not even in the packed hearing room, Environmental Conservation Commissioner Kelso took his beef to reporters in the hall. He said the bill under discussion, a liability limit of $60 million on oil spillers, would be extremely unwise in view of the amount of damage from Exxon's spill in Alaska.
I don't know how the sponsor developed the numbers in this bill, but they certainly are inadequate given the experience we just had and are still having. We should bear in mind that for many communities, this is still a continuing spill, and the entire list of damages has certainly not been developed yet.
Kelso said if the bill had been in force in March, Exxon's liability would have stopped some time ago. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Fish in the Prince William Sound area will be carefully examined before commercial fishermen are told that seasons are open this year. Before each opening, the Department of Fish and Game will be doing a test fishery. Even though the Copper River District is technically outside Prince William Sound, the Copper River Delta sockeye salmon fishery is close enough to be scrutinized. Keith Schultz, a fisheries biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game stationed in Cordova, says 300 to 600 fish are being collected.
The whole purpose of this test fisheries was to be conducted a week before to assess the quality of the fish or any possible contamination of the fish within the district.
The fish are brought to Cordova, where the Department of Environmental Conservation is conducting dockside inspections. Some of the fish will be sent to the department's lab in Palmer for more tests. Barring any negative results, the Copper River Delta season will open as scheduled.
We're expecting a harvest of about 970,000 sockeyes in Copper River, and relatively very few pinks. Historically, they catch less than 5,000 pinks.
The only legal gear in the Copper River Delta is drift gill net. That's very different from the fisheries in Prince William Sound. Their legal gear varies from district to district.
A few of them are just drift gill net districts. A few of them are just drift gill net and purse seine districts. And there's a number of them that are just purse seine districts. And the majority of the fish caught in Prince William Sound are pink salmon.
Before oil spilled from the Exxon Valdez into the water of Prince William Sound, the Department of Fish and Game expected a harvest there of about 41 million pink salmon. Hatcheries have made an enormous difference in the Prince William Sound harvest. Schultz says that the wild stock harvest was projected this year at 18 million fish. The other 23 million would be returns from the hatcheries. It's hard to say what will happen now.
With the oil spill, what kind of changes to the normal fishery pattern is yet to be assessed, but there will be some impact to the fishing habits, and probably to the fishing, the actual harvest too will be a little bit less.
In the Copper River tests, two of the boats had returned to Cordova, and so far, Schultz says the DEC dockside inspections look promising.
DEC and personnel inspected the vessels, inspected the fishing gear, and they inspected the fish themselves, and this was a visual inspection. As far as the percentages of sockeyes and chinooks, they were running roughly about 2 to 1, two sockeyes for every one chinook caught.
If all goes according to schedule, fishermen will be working soon in the Copper River Delta, 2 24-hour periods a week, usually on Mondays and Thursdays. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
When we found out that the equipment that we were planning to bring up here had another commitment and was going to be delayed a couple of weeks, so we decided to see if the Vitagoopski could stay for those few weeks, and they said they could. We were very pleased by that.
Biden realizes so many people in Alaska that needed work, and everybody that, because this sort of work, you know, you don't have to have a lot of skills to do it, so everybody showed up wanting to go to work.
Brown globs of oil were found scattered on some Homer area beaches late last week. As the tide rolled out and left the tarry masses clinging to rocks, a work crew was immediately dispatched to begin the task of cleaning it up. That work continued over the weekend. A crew of six worked at Bishop's Beach, combing the rocks back and forth across the high tide line. The crew size is expected to double to 12 later today. A foreman for the group says more patches of oil seem to come in with each tide. Meanwhile, 14 beach cleanup workers who were brought to Homer last week complaining of sickness returned to the job site at Rocky and Windy Bays. An industrial hygienist who surveyed the work conditions recommended stopping the cleanup work in warm, sunny, windless conditions that breed oil fumes. In Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
This weekend, the Alaska tourist industry met in Anchorage to encourage themselves and then others to discover Alaska. The Alaska Visitors Association, AVA, chose the Governor's Conference on Tourism to announce the emergency marketing plan it hopes will change perceptions about Alaska's scenic wonders after the spill. Tom Dow, president of the Alaska Visitors Association, spoke to the conference participants.
AVA has a responsibility to 600 member businesses and 20,000 Alaskans who are employed in this industry. As Alaskans, we can share the concern and sadness of our neighbors in the coastal communities that we all love to visit. And at the same time, we can confidently state that today, 7 weeks after the Exxon Valdez grounding, the heavily traveled route between Whittier and Valdez through Prince William Sound is unspoiled.
The plan to get that message across to potential tourists from the lower 48 is funded by a $4 million grant from Exxon, all to be spent before July 1st. Half of it will go to prime market television ads, 30-second spots targeting people the AVA sees as their most important audience.
45-year-old and over adults who have traveled over 2,000 miles on vacation within the past few years. Those are the kind of people that choose a trip to Alaska. The TV spot will run in select cities, which we refer to as our A markets, our most productive markets.
Those A markets include Cincinnati, Denver, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Portland, and San Diego. The plan is to have the TV spots on the air May 22nd. Newspaper ads in the target cities will reinforce what people hear on TV. Newspaper and magazine ads account for 18% of the budget. The third largest portion, 13%, goes to region-specific programs. It's the regional programs that are designed to help the small business specifically, the small tour operators, small lodge owners, and they're the ones Hugh Gellert, State Director of Tourism, sees as particularly hard hit.
The clients of these people are sort of the really outdoor-minded, activity-minded people. And those are the kind that the state has been in the present administration trying to put more emphasis on. We've got a big push on highway travelers and working with the Canadians to bring up more highway travelers and more fishermen. And, you know, because those people get around the state and they spend their money, they buy the groceries for themselves, they get around a lot more.
While the AVA's ads are being directed at the lower 48, Gellert says the state, through AVA, has asked Exxon for an additional $1.2 million for overseas supplementary assistance. That money would go to reassure potential Canadian, European, and Japanese tourists that Alaska is still the place to see. The decision on that money is expected this week.
We are committed under the state emergency order to have certain equipment on hand. We have everything on hand except some high-capacity skimming equipment and storage barge, which will be stationed at Knoll's Head on a long-term basis. So to make up for that lack, we have hired the Vita Gubsky to be on standby contingency work for our oil spill recovery plan.
Well, the National Transportation Safety Board is an independent, non-regulatory agency. From the standpoint of what legal action can we take to enforce recommendations, we have none. However, from the standpoint of subpoenaing witnesses, that's exactly what we do. But in the government sense, we send friendly subpoenas, and in most cases, they are accepted.
What if they're not accepted? I understand, for instance, that former Captain Joseph Hazelwood has declined to testify. How can you conduct an investigation without the testimony of the captain?
Well, we will be conducting or getting information from several other crew members. We have a total of 8 from the crew if everybody shows up, and we anticipate that they will. That is our hope. So the fact that we don't have the master, that's unfortunate, but I understand from, and we agree with his constitutional rights, and his attorney has recommended to him that he not testify.
What's the usual procedure in a hearing like this? For instance, who can ask questions, and what sort of the order of questioning?
What happens is after each person, each witness comes on the stand, he or she is sworn in and they're qualified. They give some information about their background and why they're qualified to answer the questions that we're going to pose to them. The safety board begins by asking various questions. That is then followed by the spokespersons for each of the parties. They will then ask questions. That will then be followed by questions from the Board of Inquiry, of which I chair.
When you talk about qualifying witnesses, will your witnesses be primarily people who are directly concerned in the accident or the aftermath of the accident, or will you have technical testimony as well?
We'll have all. We will have people that are associated directly with the accident. For example, as I said, we will have 8 crew members. We will have people from the Coast Guard who are operating the vessel traffic system at Valdez. We will have people that can talk policy from both Alyeska Pipeline and Exxon, and we'll also have some technical experts dealing with drug and alcohol abuse.
This seems like a monumental job. What would you say that you'll be looking for in the testimony, and what essentially will be the result?
Well, what we'll be looking for, we have identified 7 major issues that we'd like to pursue. And after identifying those issues, we then identified various people who can speak to those issues and help us explore and flesh out those issues at the hearing. So we'll be asking specific questions about the accident, the events leading up to the accident, so that would help us in determining the probable cause and whatever recommendations we deem are necessary.
What are some of those 7 major issues you'll be looking at?
Well, we're looking at the navigation watch, what was going on at the time of the occurrence or up to the event happening itself soon after midnight. We'll look at the role of human factors and alcohol involvement and drug involvement and programs that Exxon and Coast Guard have in place, rules on alcohol and drug abuse. We'll be looking at the role of the Coast Guard's vessel traffic system and what is their responsibility, what is the Coast Guard's responsibility in monitoring and tracking vessels through the Narrows and out into the Prince William Sound, and also the initial response to the accident and the contingency plan for responding to an accident.
What will be the result? What will your report essentially say, and what's the timeline on that?
Well, the safety board is mandated, it's required by law to investigate transportation accidents to determine probable cause. So one of the things that will be in the report, which probably won't be released until probably 9 or 10 months from now, but it will identify the probable cause. It'll also include any conclusions or findings that will come out of this investigation, as well as any recommendations that we deem necessary to prevent this from occurring again in the future.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your time, and we'll be watching this, of course, with a great deal of interest. I wish you personally the best. It sounds like a marathon to me.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that, and we'll be around to help you all week if we can.
Nearly 20 years after a barge ran aground off the coast of West Falmouth, Massachusetts, spilling almost 200,000 gallons of heating fuel, the shoreline area is now, at least to the nose and eye, clean.
Boston Globe writer Jerry Ackerman says no oil spill in history has had the same impact on science as the West Falmouth spill. It occurred almost in the lap of the renowned Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and biologist George Hampson and his colleagues were eager for a chance to set oil pollution records straight. They've studied the spill on and offshore for two decades. Many believe their work provides the most thorough chronicles of oil pollution ever. Within days after Alaska's Exxon Valdez spill, Exxon representatives visited Hampson at his Woods Hole office, seeking advice on what might lie ahead for the diverse marine environment being devastated by over 10 million gallons of Alaska crude. Hampson said without even looking at the area, they could expect recovery to take at least 10 years. Hampson admits he's at a disadvantage because he hasn't yet been to Alaska, but he thinks Exxon's end-of-summer time frame for cleaning up the spill is unrealistic.
From looking at the photographs, which I see on television, it's incomprehensible how in the world it would be cleaned up in such a short time.
Hampson also believes it's unrealistic to say the oil won't sink to the bottom. He says unless and until it's examined by sampling in great detail, it's futile to suggest otherwise.
If there's a lot of sedimentation going on, if there's a great deal of mixing and violent mixing from storms, you're starting to look at emulsification. You're starting to look at the oil being clinging onto particles and wanting to go to the bottom. That is real. That is absolutely real. It happens. It's part of the cleaning process of the surface, but it also, that oil goes someplace. It doesn't evaporate. It doesn't just go off and out to sea. It'll fall down on the bottom.
Hampson says the long-term effects of an oil spill will be worse than the immediate ones. He says beaches may start to appear clean after 2 years. Areas where oil is restricted from moving out, such as small bays, will likely take up to 5 years. Marshes in West Falmouth still had evidence of oil 15 years later. Hampson says offshore waters appeared to be pretty much back to normal in about 2 years, but he stresses the importance of long-term testing in those areas that can't be seen.
See, what happens is the immediate effects are the most striking. And no matter what you do, everything is negative. That eventually goes away because you've lived with it a little bit and animals are less frequently coming into the shore. But what happens offshore in the areas where you don't see, and that's what has to be looked at, and the ramifications of that over time. Unless you study offshore, unless you know what's going on in total, it's hard to make a prediction. It's hard to tell that it's cleared up. So you've got to get out there and take plenty of samples and be aware of what's going on.
Hampson hopes to come to Alaska soon as part of a scientific team from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. But despite the damage caused by the nation's worst man-made catastrophe, George Hampson truly believes that once again, nature will prevail.
Absolutely. Yep. It'll take time. In spite of how we try to screw up our planet, nature always seems to adjust.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
The investigation will focus on seven specific issues that bear on the grounding of the supertanker and the response to the oil spill that followed. Among them, the navigation of the vessel, what was happening on the bridge when the Exxon Valdez strayed so far from the normal tanker lanes. Other questions will probe the operation of the U.S. Coast Guard's vessel tracking system, the initial response of the shipping company, state and federal agencies, and the role of alcohol and drugs. Lee Dickinson will chair the Board of Inquiry. He said the panel expects to call 28 witnesses.
We will have eight crew members. We will have people from the Coast Guard who were operating the vessel traffic system at Valdez. We will have people that can talk policy from both Alyeska Pipeline and Exxon, and we'll also have some technical experts dealing with drug and alcohol abuse.
The one key witness who will not appear is Captain Joseph Hazelwood. The former master of the Exxon Valdez is facing state and possible federal charges in connection with allegations that he was drunk on duty when the tanker went on the rocks. He's refused to testify on the advice of his lawyers. The hearings are expected to continue through Saturday. For CBC News, this is Corey Flintoff in Anchorage, Alaska.
The hearings will leave little to the imagination by the time they're done. While many of the pieces of the puzzle of what happened on the night of March 23rd are known, investigators say the media have yet to put them together in the right pattern. The missing piece is why the captain left the bridge and the tanker kept on a course that took it straight into a well-known navigation hazard. The picture is complicated by a succession of watch changes shortly before the crash. Board of Inquiry Chairman Lee Dickinson says they will try to answer that and other questions without the testimony of Captain Joe Hazelwood, who wanted immunity.
We have a total of 8 from the crew if everybody shows up, and we anticipate that they will. That is our hope. So the fact that we don't have the master, that's unfortunate, but I understand from, and we agree, with his constitutional rights, and his attorney has recommended to him that he not testify.
The NTSB hearings are planned to spill over into the weekend. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Well, we expect to have a little trouble here for the next few days because the radios that these animals are equipped with are on their hind flippers, and when they swim, those hind flippers will be underwater, and we won't get radio signals as long as the flippers are in the water. If the animals rest, though, as soon as they start to slow down a little bit, then we should be able to find them.